Hi, this is Betsy at the Legislative Information Office, ready to do a sound check.
Hello, this is Lori Brick at the Legislative Information Office.
Well, hello there. You sound fantastic.
How about this one?
That one sounds even more fantastic.
Testing.
Sounds good. Yep, sounds good.
1, 2, 3.
Sounds good.
4, 5, 6.
Sounds good.
7, 8, 9.
Sounds good.
2019.
Sounds good. Wow, sounds good.
32, 23, 46.
Sounds good.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. Testing, 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3.
Okay, thank you.
Testing, 1, 2, 3.
The other timer has to pop up. There we go. Now.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3.
You will please come to order. I'd like to have you call the roll, please.
Representative Keller.
Present.
Representative Millett.
Excused.
Representative Christ Thompson.
Here.
Representative Davis.
Here.
Representative Hughes.
Here.
Representative Isaacson.
Here.
Chair Lim.
Here. Okay, this morning we have four items on the agenda. First one is HB 274, involving hearings on the referenda, and HGR 18, involving the constitutional amendment proposing elected attorney general. Third is HB 275, electronic distribution of reports and notices. And fourth is HB 199, VPSO, Village Public Safety Officer, being allowed to carry firearms. So with that, let's go to HB 274 first. Is Representative Millett's staff here to speak to that? Good morning, sir. Would you like to introduce yourself and then introduce the bill here?
Thank
or
you, Mr.
continue
Chairman.
With it again?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jeff Turner, staff for Representative Millett. Well, as Representative Millett explained during the last hearing, House Bill 274 is a simple bill. It just extends the public hearing requirements for referendums, which was it's kind of an add-on to House Bill 36 that was passed by the legislature back in 2010. Referendums are not very common on the ballot, but they do happen. In fact, we'll have one later this year. So,
would you explain to the folks listening the difference between a referendum and an initiative?
Well, an initiative is a voter-initiated item on the ballot that allows the public to enact a piece of legislation in place of the legislature, where a referendum will repeal a law that was passed by the legislature.
I see. Okay, please continue.
Well, as I said, it will extend the public hearing requirements for referendums. It will require the lieutenant governor to hold public hearings in each of the judicial districts around the state, and it will also require a legislative hearing created by a legislative hearing of a standing committee of the legislature. Its members will be made up from the House and Senate and appointed by the two presiding officers. And with that, thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee on this? Do we have anybody online? Anybody in the audience would like to testify on this? Then I'll close public testimony. And any discussion on the table?
My chair, I really appreciate sponsor for bringing this forward. So it looks like a great bill. That's all.
President Isaacson.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. So, Mr. Chair, this seems like it's necessary and it would be consistent. And any time we ask people to vote on something, it's good to educate and have both sides. So I'm definitely supporting this.
Yes, I too think it's a good thing. You know, when all of us run for office, we put forth our platform, as it were, try to explain things. When we attempt to pass a bill, we try to explain it so people can hear it, and you get a referendum, and sometimes there's not enough explanation for it, and we need to have those public hearings. It was the will of the committee, Vice Chair Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to say that, just to state the obvious, that disagreement on issues that come up like this cause a vetting process that makes the whole system work, and I always learn things when we're fighting and discussing.
Intense debate.
So, Mr. Chair, I will move HB 74 version A out of committee with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Okay, any objection? If not, HB 274 hereby passes from committee. Thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, next on our agenda today is H.R. 18, Constitutional Amendment, Elected Attorney General. Representative Stoltz, I see you here. Please come forward, identify yourself, and speak again to the bill. I believe we previously heard, but we didn't really do much more than just give the title, as I recall.
Thanks, Chairman Lennon, members of the committee.
And move the mic a little forward here, please.
Bill Stoltz, represent House District 11, communities of Chugiak and southern rural Mat-Su.
Okay.
And as Chairman Lynn indicated, we had a probably less than 10-minute, a little bit of dialogue, very short narrative by me on my reasons for having Alaska join 43 other states in electing the Attorney General and providing a direct representative for the people of Alaska.
Would you give some what you consider to be the pros and the cons of this? Every bill has pros and cons, just about. Would you, from your perspective, would you give that to us?
Sure. Please forgive me if I let other people make their own arguments against it, but I can certainly, probably broadly identify some of the critiques. But, I think the pro, I think the positive side of electing an attorney general is the attorney general would it would certainly sanctify that is the people's lawyer. Often the attorney generals call themselves that, but really in de facto it's the governor's lawyer. And we happen to have a good governor, I believe, but it's not a reflection of this attorney general and this governor, but a much broader philosophical reason that I am promoting for. This is not for this year. This is for the future of Alaska, and as I'm looking prospectively.
If this were to pass, that'd be for the upcoming ballot.
Chairman Lynn, would put this on the ballot and as constitutional amendments subsequent to 1972 have to appear on the general election ballot, which was also changed by the Constitution, requiring all constitutional amendments appear on the general election.
Would that be potentially on the upcoming general election in November?
It would not potentially. If the legislature ratifies this by the 2/3 votes in each body, it would be on the
upcoming general election.
And it would be it would be in the hands of the voters, who I have an imminent trust in. Some folks have suggested if we elected an attorney general, it might be political. Well, anybody who has watched attorney generals in the state of Alaska, I know they already are political by nature. I trust that Alaskans would vet their candidates just as they do us. If we don't trust the political process, I wonder why we're all justifying sitting here. But, I trust them just as much in selecting an attorney general as they do selecting us. And maybe that's one of the cons that people might say, but or critics. But
not in your case.
If you believe in democracy, the people can never be wrong.
Is it possible to have an elected attorney general from one party and a governor from another party?
Yes, it is, and it happens probably a dozen other states at this time, maybe 10 or 11, I can't recall. That's a reflection of the will of the voters. I'm not sure there should be a mandate that should be of the same party. I think the stronger mandate it should be that it's a person that will support the Constitution of the United States, the state of Alaska, and serve the people of Alaska, not a political party.
Thank you. Representative Isaacson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Or the governor.
Representative Soltz, you almost have me convinced, especially because of the events here recently. Sometimes if you don't have that iron sharpening iron and not a direct line of accountability in place, you might have a different outcome. You might have more scrutiny on issues and so forth. I'm just concerned, like the chair had just mentioned, that early in the American constitutional experiment, you know, it was possible to elect a vice president who was of a different party than the president, and they saw fit to close that gap. Is there a way, perhaps, that we could close that gap so that if people are electing a governor of one party, they could also then have, similar to the lieutenant governor and so forth, a ticket? Or is that going to bring too close of a tie back, in your estimation?
Representative Lynn, Representative Isaacson, that's certainly a possibility. And that's much like we do tie the lieutenant governor together, and it's tethered And the difference is all other appointments, the lieutenant governor is elected by the people and but does not require confirmation and can't be removed by the governor. Those would be the two differences. That's the committee process. That's imminently possible to do that. And this is I'm hoping that whether you decide to propose that change here or let the Judiciary Committee with Chairman Keller do that. I mean, that's your call. However, this is the Constitution is a living document, and it does provide an opportunity for change, and that's one of the things we're discussing. And this is the process of which you are co-agents in that change, and will help mold whatever product we may or may not get to the voters. So, I think that's total within the realm of possibility. I am very flexible on giving the voters a chance here, but I am very respectful of the committee process, and you are agents involved in that process.
And through the chair.
Continue, please.
Thank you. So, and I appreciate that very much, that we know that we're part of the process, but I was just wondering, because you've got some set ideas, how would that be affecting the intent of your legislation, of your bill?
Representative Isaacson, through Chairman Lynn, I think you'd still be following the principle of the people electing. It's just a slightly different mechanism, and it might cause less discomfort for folks worrying about a different party. It's not an overriding concern of mine, but it might be of the voters, as you're reflecting the views of voters you represent. So that's certainly I don't view any good ideas or constructive thoughts negatively. How do we work constructively to make this the best possible proposed amendment to put to the voters? And there's a lot of subjectivity and judgment call in the process you set up. I probably borrowed similar language from other attempts, and as Representative Isaacson has suggested, that if there is a concern of folks about having a different party, not something I fear, is that a different party would be a reflection of the voters, but if it provides people more comfort, that if everybody believes every Republican is concomitant in their views, they haven't watched all the governors and lieutenant governors, I'm not sure it would solve everything you'd want to solve, but if it does, I think it would have the same net result, because that person would be elected by the voters, could not be removed by the governor for it could only be removed as any other person could by probably an impeachment process. Or a recall, I guess.
Representative Hughes and then Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Representative Stoltz, for bringing this forward. One of the consequences, and some might view this as a pro, and some might view this as a con, and I'll probably get in trouble for my family because I come from a family of attorneys, but I would see that some might see this as the Attorney General elected position as a training ground for a governor, and that we might end up with a lot more attorneys as governor than we would otherwise. And so that, to some, as I said, might be a pro, and some might be a con. But one of the pros that I see is that I think, and I would ask if you would agree with this, that it might reduce the turnover. We've had a lot of attorney generals, and I understand in other states that they will often serve the full four-year term and often go on to a second or third term. And I believe yours limits it at two, but do you think this will impact turnover, and how do you see that as a plus for Alaska?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, first, congratulations on rising above your surroundings.
Would you care to expand on that? No.
No, I know her family, and they are actually great people. But turnover is an issue. I think the average turn of the attorney general is about 18 months. I think that would provide more stability. The person wouldn't be subject to the whim of a political disagreement. Between the governor, where they might feel that the governor isn't representing the people, or any other disagreement. I don't recall a lieutenant governor who's ever resigned. The disagreements occur, but the governor has to still have that cordial relationship with that person that's down the hallway out of view. But the Attorney General, I think, has other, probably would have more powers than the Lieutenant Governor would, of not be in the line of succession, though. But yes, stability, I think, would be greatly enhanced, and I would suspect it would help morale in the Department of Law, knowing that they had one person, and you never know who the next is, without the vagaries of that steady turnover that we experience in our Alaskan Attorney Generals.
Would there be, I suppose not, but would there be any additional cost in putting another person running for election on the ballot?
Generally, there's a standard fiscal note on anything that's put on the ballot. It's around $1,500 for printing an extra page of the book. That's the fiscal note we get on constitutional amendments or other measures, bond measures that we're putting for the ballot. And that's often the reason we see all these measures in the Finance Committee, is because of the cost of elections. But it's de minimis. It's two TV commercials, right? Or maybe one. I don't know.
Representative Gaddis.
I guess in looking at the current governors and attorney general sheet that you passed out, my question would be, why now, besides the obvious that most of the other states are doing this?
Okay. Representative Lynn, through the chair, I wasn't here 30 years ago or 50 years ago. I'm here now, and it's others have pushed the measure in the past. It's not that I'm the first one that thought of this. I think actually the last three attempts, I think, were pushed by members of the other party. Maybe the last four, I think Representative Crawford, and I think either Representative or Senator Davis. It's been a bipartisan issue, and probably bipartisan in opposition as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Excuse me, Vice Chair Keller.
It's more of a statement than a question, but looking forward to getting the bill in Judiciary, and we'll evaluate the questions that have been raised about, maybe the partisan issue and the how a AG is removed. But I just want to show my cards right now is that I really appreciate this bill. I'm glad you're bringing it forward. It's one that needs to be considered. I see the end result of an elected AG philosophically from the 100,000-foot level is more informed electorate, and I think that is really valuable to us. I think we tend to sometimes forget that attorneys have varying philosophies, they have varying expertise, and by campaigning you would see where they come from. One might be a prosecutor, one might be a defense attorney. And in a system where crimes are against the state, and the Attorney General is also the commissioner of the Department of Law, I think it's very, very valuable for the people of Alaska to be able to know who their Attorney General is. That's my bias at this point. But because of that, I would just say a thank you, for bringing it forward. And I don't want to say that I'll be closed-minded to suggestions that come up in Judiciary, but it would be unfair to not state my bias. So thank you.
Okay. I have somebody wants. Well, first let me ask. Obviously, the Attorney General is basically a commissioner. Also, would it then be appropriate to elect all the different commissioners?
Well, Chairman Lynn, I'm not delving into that debate. I think the position of Attorney General rises to a much higher level. The action of the average Attorney General on any given day can make law far faster than us, and it has a lot more powers. The opinion of an Attorney General can nullify a statute or a regulation, has the force of law, and that's a pretty strong power. Right now, we just have an Attorney General that just turned down a citizens' initiative. It was a lieutenant governor, but it was the opinion of an assistant attorney general, and I guess signed by the attorney general. Why? I guess, you know, saying that out loud, that bothers me a little bit. Not the content of the initiative, but an assistant attorney general has more power than the people of Alaska.
Okay.
With no answerability, no accountability.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in looking at this, as I look back on municipal experience, whether it was in the city or on an assembly, the assemblies and the councils usually have the power to hire and fire the city attorney or the borough attorney. So in my tenure as mayor, you know, I used an attorney, whichever one is there. Now, I had a good experience, but if I had wanted to get rid of that attorney because they didn't represent the interests of the city as I saw it, then it would have been a political battle. That could possibly happen. That's my only drawback. What if we don't get someone who's really representing the interests of the state and it's too cumbersome of a process to unelect them? That's the advantage of the current system. The governor could do it. So that's one statement. On the other side, if we want to have some control, why don't we follow more of the municipal model where the legislature then would hire and fire the attorney general, might insulate the political process a little bit in the sense you could respond quickly. The legislature would know whether or not the interests of the state are being served. We're elected to do that. And yet at the same time, then you wouldn't have necessarily the governor directly controlling that one function. I look at it as an executive, and I look at it as a legislator, and I look at it as a resident, and I'm trying to figure out what would be the best in view of these arguments proffered that would go forward. What's your thought?
Thank you, Representative. First, going back to Representative Lynn's question about other cabinet positions, in Alaska, in most states of the union, the agricultural director or commissioner is elected, and often a very sought-after office. In Alaska, it's a political appointment. You know what the qualifications are? Citizen of the United States. That's one of the problems. I'm not sure bringing the legislature into a process. I guess we have the ability to bring an attorney general for us, and if there's grounds, we could probably hold hearings. Sometimes an attorney general won't show up for a legislative hearing. We had during a previous administration, there was an attorney general who was appointed by a previous governor, not wanting to go through a confirmation process with the attorney general. The next governor kept that attorney general, and that attorney general would often even decline to appear before the judiciary committees or would send surrogates. So it's a political position now, and I really don't know. You want to talk really throw a muck in there is make that would require a constitutional amendment, I believe, to put that kind of powers for the legislature to micromanage the attorney general. And frankly, I don't want to micromanage the attorney general. I want him to work for the people. And that's that position, just like the lieutenant governor, comes before the legislature and the budget, so that attorney general would do the same thing. But I think an attorney general that's working for the people would have no problem with the appropriation process here, just like they don't right now. But there are definitely fair critiques of this process, but there's a lot of critiques about the way it's working right now as well.
Yes. Chris Tompkins.
One question and one comment. The question is, in states where you have an attorney general and a governor of different parties, or even of the same party and of different philosophies, are there pronounced examples of ideological or conflict or even conflict in matters of sort of day-to-day or year-to-year governance? And my comment is, in Alaska may be unique or at least different from these other states in that it seems there has to be a lot of coordination between the Department of Law and the rest of the executive branch because of the tremendously profound resource issues we have in the state with oil and gas and litigation relating to oil and gas, or even statewide initiatives such as Choose Respect, which crosses many departments. And so my question and subtle concern is that if you have an attorney general of one party, you're just totally off on his and her own place, and a governor that's trying to do something else, you might lose that coordination and what that looks like in other states and if that would be a pronounced risk in Alaska.
Thank you, Representative Tompkins, for the chair. I guess no more than having a lieutenant governor who doesn't get along or want to coordinate and or might. I've even heard that we've had lieutenant governors who didn't support the reelection of the governor's daughter. You know, I mean, talk about a profound difference. And I'm not, I mean, I don't think I'm letting anything out of the bag that there are in our, just with our lieutenant governor, so do we want to eviscerate and make sure the governor gets to handpick his lieutenant governor as well? That works for the people. And there are potential issues. I think, there are conflicts in other states. Sometimes attorney generals will run against the governor. Just like in some states, we sometimes have politically ambitious lieutenant governors who are thinking of running for governor or other statewide offices. It happens. I don't know. You could put a prohibition. I don't know if it's constitutional that you can't run for another office. I don't know if sometimes trying to figure out how to stop politics, you inject more politics. And some might say about me bringing up this whole issue in the first place, that maybe I'm making the problem worse. I believe, but I'm getting a lot of support from my constituency from this and from colleagues and saying, I wish I would have done that bill, or I hope we get to vote on that. I think, and again, it's not a frustration of any of our current folks, but I think you could probably nitpick a lot of examples on any governor, any attorney general, and make critiques. And we've had some very good examples where folks worked together and did great things for the people of Alaska. But it's not a guarantee either elected or appointed. Just like it's not a guarantee you're going to have a governor or a lieutenant governor that's going to provide the satisfaction that you want.
Okay. Representative Hughes.
Thank you. I appreciate the fact that you're pointing out how this would cause the Attorney General to be more accountable to the people. And I value the intelligence of the citizens of Alaska and would hope and pray that it wouldn't become a beauty contest and a public speaking contest, which sometimes elections can be. And so I trust that there, just like in the prior legislation where we were seeking to inform the electorate, that that there would be a healthy debate, and really, because someone who perhaps isn't a good public speaker could be a really good attorney general. So I just want to point that out. And I do support this, even though I don't like the idea of thinking there'll be more yard signs around, but I think it would be a very healthy process. I do have one question, and I appreciate the fact, too, that judiciary will be looking at whether will there be some way to recall an attorney general. I think that's an important part that is missing here. But I was wondering, would this be the race, would it go on the primary ballot then, and would it be by party, or would it be a kind of a free-for-all and on the general with a long list of names? Just how would that be set up?
First, I represent views for the chair. With the exception of the two fair ladies on the ends, this is obviously not a beauty contest. And that selects us, and I'm not the greatest
public
speaker.
How about the bill sponsor, sir?
Yeah, and myself included. And that's as I was going to say. So sometimes politics is sometimes like the Hollywood for ugly people. So, and my son, there.
Any hope you had with this bill is out of here.
Yeah. But the way the bill reads, it would be the same nominating process and election process as for lieutenant governor. Really, lieutenant governor is almost written as an exemption from the other cabinet positions. So it treats it as just as lieutenant governor's race. It's it would be a following that it would be a primary, and it could be other than it as it as the Constitution amendment is now, would be a standalone. There could be an iteration. It could become part. Maybe it might be a triad. If that's what the legislative process yields of your best and brightest three men and women, or three women, or three men, two men and a woman, whatever. I could go all day with that one.
My principle, this is a very interesting concept. My particular hang-up on this is that if I were the governor, or running for governor, but if I were the governor, and by the way, I'm making an announcement, I am not running for governor, so all the other folks who are so all the other folks who are running for governor can rest easy and relax. But that said, I could see being the governor, and everybody knows, I hope, you know, I'm very pro-life, and somebody who totally the opposite could get elected as attorney general, and then I go to the attorney general for advice on some, say, pro-life bill, and I'm talking to somebody who's philosophically and otherwise opposed to the whole thing. That and you take any subject in the world like that, it seems to me that your attorney general who's advising the governor on the pros and cons of any particular bill should have someone in the same, not necessarily one mind, but in the same philosophical ballpark. How do you answer that? Because the attorney general does advise the governor on all kinds of legislation as well as other things. That really concerns me. Now, I know that the governor could go out and get his own attorney or get somebody else to answer some of those questions, but then you've lost the benefit of the attorney general, who should be the expert on these things. And so, if I were governor, I'd want somebody in my same philosophical ballpark when I go to him for advice on what to do or not to do. Is this constitutional? Is it not constitutional? Et cetera. How do you respond to that?
Sure. Representative Lynn's chair. And if you believe the governor, the attorney general should first and foremost serve the governor as his political and legal advisor, this is probably not a constitutional amendment you can support. This is to make that candidate for that position a representative of the people directly. And it's I guess I can't. I can't give you comfort that the attorney general will always be in first and foremost consider himself the top legal advisor to the governor if he represents the people of Alaska and has a higher calling. So if that is a stumbling block that the attorney general first and foremost has to serve as the legal advisor and confidant to the governor, then instead of serving the people, then I may not be able to get your vote on this one.
Good. All of the commissioners, they serve the governor, but they also serve the people. And our current attorney general and previous attorney generals, they also serve. You know, the governor is elected to serve the people, as all of us are elected to serve the people. But by advising the governor on the proper course of action, the constitutionality, for example, thing, would that not also be serving the people?
Well, in that construct, I can't envision every scenario where there's a conflict. But I think there's always when you're a lawyer has a canon of ethics on the way our Constitution and the appointment process and the terms of service are now, it is first and foremost the attorney general is the governor's attorney, and much like an attorney has the responsibility to defend a man who may be guilty, and I'm not trying to cast aspersions on anybody, but it's a different relationship when the attorney general first and foremost is the governor's attorney, and it's This is it's not comfortable talking because I it may sound like I'm arraigning motives or suggesting a less than savory situation because that's not the everyday occurrence.
Could there be perhaps like a middle ground, say, an amendment that would at least get someone in the same philosophical ballpark of being in the same party? Would that be a good thing or a bad thing in your opinion?
And Mr. Chair, I think I said that was certainly I'm amenable to the deliberations of the committee, and I think that was one of the suggestions, having that person on the ticket. I think philosophy isn't something we can define by statute, and party doesn't necessarily define philosophy, as we know from some of our critics.
Okay. Representative Hughes, and then I'm going to go have somebody on the line. Gaddis.
Hard to tell the difference with the beauty. I'm still stuck there. I can understand.
Might have two votes. I'm not sure.
But I guess just a comment. As I hear the discussion back and forth, I think most of us get the fact that if we were appointed by somebody, we certainly have a certain allegiance by who may have appointed us, versus if we're elected by somebody else, the voters, we certainly have an allegiance there. So I think that's the question that's before us. I mean, I think in my mind, it's relatively simple as who we work for.
Very good. Representative Keller, Vice Chair Keller.
Yeah, on that topic, I think one thing we need to remember is that the legal counsel to the governor is not just the AG, as when he is the head of the Department of Law, he has many deputy commissioners, and a lot of those deputy commissioners are the ones that actually give the counsel in the specific areas, you know. And so by electing an attorney general, I think we would begin to see that process better in the electorate. So it's not just the governor's personal advisor. It's he is the head of a whole army of advisors for the various departments within the state. And so when the attorney general gives an opinion to the governor, of course, it's not his own unilateral sole advice. It is often the counsel of the whole Department of Law, or it's all included or considered.
And I would assume, though, deputy attorney generals, whatever, they don't want to irritate their boss too much, I wouldn't think, either, by coming up with opposite opinions on everything.
And Mr. Chair.
Reverend Isaacson.
On this, I was going to save this discussion for when we actually discussed it, but if you're giving us the latitude to incorporate discussion with our colleague here as a sponsor.
Well, we're
going to
discuss here.
Do you want
public testimony, but go ahead now. I mean,
well,
have
okay,
our,
so
we'll have a discussion later.
I'm going to broach this and then come back to it during discussion.
Right.
Because as you made the distinction, the polarity is the attorney general serving the governor, or is he serving the people? And I think that is an important distinction, but not an altogether accurate distinction. When you look at what an attorney general is, the all-knowing Wikipedia, which I just checked, says it is the advisor to the governor. But then Encyclopedia Britannica, a much more wise one, says that it's the chief law officer of a state or nation and the legal advisor to the chief executive. So everyone seems to recognize some aspect that the AG is going to advise the governor, and that's where the rub seems to be. But they also are the chief legal counsel for the state, so the government. There's a distinction, I think, in governor and government, and government is of the people, but at the same time, we're government as well, and we make laws, and so in some aspects, the AG needs to advise us, but then also the AG is looking out for things, as you mentioned, Representative Keller, beyond our borders, the attacks against our state, infringements of law, whether it comes from D.C. or elsewhere. So the crux to me is not whether or not I believe that the AG is going to serve the people or serve the governor. I think it comes down to where is the best line of accountability to be drawn in this fight to make sure that we have a philosophy that has been elected where people normally think of that as the philosophy of the chief executive, the of the governor is the prevailing will of the people at that time. And so the person that is defending that vision, in one aspect, you need to make sure that they've got a legal leg to stand on, and that's where the AG comes in. And so they're supposed to be protecting us. I'll save part of this, but I think it harks back to the 17th Amendment, something we should consider as a corollary. But just in this, Representative Soltz, I'm wondering, because I know that you're a deep well when it comes to thoughts and things of this nature. As you read the distinction between governor, people, and government, how would you weigh in on my thoughts right here? How would you educate my thinking so that I might align more to this? Because I'm not quite there. I see value in this, but I'm not certain that it. The unintended consequence might be greater than what we expect.
Certainly.
That's an excellent question.
Certainly, I think it's a good distinction, and I think they have there's differences and similarities, and when you're representing the government, and I think by extension, I think that's also you're representing the people's interests as well. I would hope if things are working as they should, and that could extend to an elected attorney general. Certainly would have his own initiatives. We might see an attorney general Governor Parnell, what Attorney General Sullivan did on Choose Respect. You might have seen that even faster from an attorney general on domestic violence, and same with consumer protection. You might see things that might be more responsiveness in the government serving the people. I can think of a lot of other. It might give the on issues on some of our weighty resource issues. It might give the public a lot more confidence in our resource decisions, that decisions were made independently without a forced concomitance of political thought. I think that the Attorney General, in serving his position, serving the government and the functions of the departments, whether it's natural resources or the consumer protection, or we've seen probably a lot more activism out of attorney generals in questioning things that happen in the government as well. They're responsive to the people, where when you're a co-employee, you just don't have that same optic or prism. And I don't know if I answered your question, but I think I'm trying to get near it. But I
appreciate that.
Very good. Representative Hughes.
I was just thinking, right now the governor signs the paychecks of all the state employees. How would the relationship be with the Department of Law if we had an elected attorney general, as he would be their boss? So would the governor have any say if there were people within the department that he didn't feel should be there anymore? Just how would that relationship work? It would be different than what we have now, obviously.
Well, as it works in other states, Representative Hughes, for the chair, it's the legislature has the appropriation process and the management of departments, and much like similar to the court system. OMB doesn't review the court budget, and the governor and the court system presents that budget to the legislative branch, the appropriation process, and a lot of this would be defined and fine-tuned. You can't put the specificity of all the enabling language within the constitutional amendment. Our constitution would be a lot thicker if we didn't. A lot less difficult to. This provides the election. how it's implemented and some of the fine-tuning, just like the after the implementation of the permanent fund or the Victims' Rights Constitutional Amendment, the implementation has been done by the legislature and fine-tuned over a period of years. But it, I would envision that the Attorney General would present the budget to the legislative arm.
We're going to follow up, Representative Hughes.
And perhaps you know what other states. I'm thinking of perhaps a particular assisted Attorney General that might be problematic for the governor. And it's not the legislative session. We're not in the appropriation process. And in other states, does the governor have any say if it's an elected attorney general over, because right now the governor would, so how, I'm assuming they wouldn't then?
Representative Hughes for the chair, I'm not going to try to answer a question I don't know, because I couldn't answer it adequately, and I don't want to do it erroneously.
Okay, thank you.
It's a good question.
Follow up. I was just wondering how in other states as it would be a different relationship, but I can see that's something we could sort out, like you said, through the implementation.
To the chair, different states have different personnel rules and different. I don't think we'd be eviscerating the employee rights. But it's a good question, and I apologize. I didn't anticipate every question and answer in advance, but that's part of this process.
Thank you.
You've done well. I'm going to go online now. Mike Coons, are you there? Mike Coons, are you online?
Yes, sir.
Okay, please identify yourself and your affiliation and give us your testimony on this very important bill.
Yes, sir. My name is Mike Coons. I'm from Palmer, and I'm speaking for myself. And
speak up a little bit, please.
Yeah, my name is Mike Coons, and I'm speaking for myself from Palmer. And I've sent a written portion of my testimony, but I would like to add one thing based on just what you guys were talking about. I think the main issue, be it the governor determining who his or her attorney general should be, I would hope, just like a lot of us, we don't want a yes man or a yes woman working for us. We want somebody that's going to come back and tell us when we're wrong, as well as when we're right, or even when we're right, trying to shoot holes through a situation and work and come out with a better product. But that said, I support HJR 18. I have a question on page one, line 16, and page two, line one, where it says, shall meet qualifications for Superior Court judge. No person that I have ever seen run for judge will answer any question on criminal penalties, views on minimum or maximum sentences, etc. The stated reason is, quote, they may have to make a decision on that issue, end quote. Will we be reduced to candidates who campaign on how long they've been a judge, a lawyer, how long they've been in Alaska and their fine family? Or are we going to get something substantive? We need to know if the AG will stand for the law, will fight back against federal overreach, and give sound advice to the legislature without waffling, as I have seen from this existing Department of Law. Lastly, I struggled about this position being vetted, appointed, approved, and appointed by the governor. I felt that the governor and the legislature were in a better position to determine the best AG. However, that view changed with comments from a senator who believed that he and the legislature, by college education and superior knowledge on these matters, especially concerning the constitutional amendment, were better suited to make that decision for the voters. Frankly, I will trust my fellow voters to make a valued decision, and I will not give up my vote. So please pass out HJR 18, and I thank you, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, sir.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Stoltz had a comment.
Just very briefly, and appreciate the point raised by Mr. Coons. I don't want to confuse this with the judicial appointment process. We are not looking at adopting that skewed process whereby the Bar Association selects the list of judges. This was basically adopting a qualification that previous bills have had, and it's just similar to citizenship, residency in Alaska, and that's a subjective point of view. Somebody that's a member of the Alaska Bar would actually be fine with me, because I think a well-trained lawyer would be eligible for appointment to a superior court judgeship. But this is not to be confused with the judicial council process. It's just the qualifications, not adopting that process in which the Bar Association selects the judges that go to the governor in the limited list, sometimes as few as two. No association other than that qualification, which is I'm not married to. It was just a previous iteration of the bill.
Very good. Thank you. Anybody else online to testify? Anybody else in the audience would wish to testify? Good. Close public testimony and back to the committee for discussion. Everybody said their say. I would ask the vice chair here, who's also chair of the Judiciary Committee. I don't really want to address it here, but maybe we could all consider the potential of an amendment that would limit it to somebody in the same party, and I think that might be better done, if it's done at all, in the judiciary than it would be done here. So maybe get our heads around that. Did you have a comment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I did, and thank you. So I agree with what you're saying. I'm wondering if conceptually we should be looking at that, but you're passing it to judiciary, and I can appreciate for the reasons.
Call a lateral pass.
Sure. And so if I do this, I'll do it. I'll pass it out with no recommendations, because I would have a recommendation that we do have this conceptual amendment in place. I see a lot of disruption of good governance, and I don't think the people want us to have a disruption and fighting and bickering in a dysfunctional situation. And going back to the testimony we just heard and the conversation. Back in the days when they passed the 17th Amendment, they thought it would be a great idea if senators were not selected out of the states but would be voted on by the people. And I have great confidence in the people. But I do know that sometimes we make mistakes as voters and we correct it later on. So the first attempt at a vote may not be the best attempt, but it ultimately gets corrected. The people ultimately are the best government. And when we get it as close to them as possible, that's good governance. I believe that. But when it comes to certain matters of law, we don't always understand. And so we pass that torch to some others who will bury themselves either by current education or continued education like we do in the process. But even when it comes to other matters of law, you want to make sure you've got not just a good lawyer, but also the philosophy is right and the understanding of the state is right. One of the values of having a governor appoint the attorney general is that the governor has been elected to serve according to a vision that the people resonated with. And in order to get that done, he or she needs to make sure that they have department heads that will toe the line. Now, that doesn't always happen. And when that doesn't happen, we get dysfunctional government. But when you have someone who is recently to the state who doesn't understand our state, and we have a peculiar constitution in all aspects, and if we get somebody who doesn't understand the certain powers of our state constitution, but they've been elected by the people, and they might have just recently come from another state, and they're charismatic, and they had a great track record where they came from, but they don't understand the issues of Alaska. I just fear that day even more, because then we've got 4 years of somebody instead of maybe 18 months. I'd rather have someone gone who says, I'm not up to this challenge for whatever reasons, than someone who will endure it. I'd rather have government continue forward than it being dragged down and a dysfunctional administration as a result. We have, you know, many people say that we're a young state, but we're over 50 years old, and so am I. And I don't think that I have the excuses that I had when I was a younger man. You got some more excuses to go through. And as a state, we don't have the same excuses that we had. We can't afford to just play lightly with our future, and our future is insecure at the moment because we have too many people at the helm who don't understand even what our state constitution requires. But I would like to think that the governor is going to make sure whoever is in the AG's office does have that understanding. I would like to think that we will move forward in a way that the sponsor has articulated, that we will have resource development that's impartial and quick. But I can see how an elected AG could come in not knowing the peculiarities of our state government and shut down resource development. I see that our consumer protections might be maybe some advantage to that, but I'm just worried the states lost their power in to control congressional overreach, federal overreach. When we lost the power to insert people selected by the various legislatures into the Senate to make sure that the government was still protecting the interests of the state. I see this as one of those issues where we need to make sure we protect the interests of the state, and the populist vote isn't always the best vote the first time. I go back to that. But in this case, if we have a populist vote for somebody, we're stuck with that vote for 4 years if you elected an attorney general that could come across well but deliver poorly. Whereas, again, that idea of the appointment, even with its flaws, does protect us some way. Now, as frustrated as I am at this moment with some of the ways that that works out. So, Mr. Chair, I'm just ending this portion of my discussion by saying let's please observe that tradition and this heritage that we've built and understand why it was necessary to keep. I'd like to repeal the 17th Amendment, but keep our people in place in government to protect the state's interest. And in the same way, any examples that we can have to protect the state's interest in the biggest scheme possible if we advance this and put it forward for the vote. So I would say I could go along with this as long as we at least had alignment of parties. I don't want to see a dysfunctional government or one that's divisive to the best interests of the state,
well,
which is the people.
Well, what's the will of the committee?
Jonathan, then I'd like to respond.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'd like to respond to Doug, too.
Who's next?
Jonathan. Representative Christ Thompson.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Chair Lynn. I'd like to echo similar sentiments. I'm not entirely sure how I feel about this proposed joint resolution. But I guess I do have a lot of concerns about what its impacts, I mean, as we're hoping to build one of the largest construction projects in the history of the world, a large diameter national gas line, how the coordination between the Department of Law and the rest of the executive branch would work. And this is a project of unprecedented scope and scale and will thereby require unprecedented coordination, presumably. And I'd really be curious about of the department's sort of professional perspective on how this could affect their working relationship in the years and even decades to come. And then I also just have a general hesitation where I always greatly respect professional and technical competence and would worry that this position may be filled more by political ability than professional competence, and the two are not necessarily mutually exclusive by any means, but that's something that I weigh and consider. And then, and finally, when considering the lieutenant governor as sort of a precedent for a directly elected attorney general, I think by all intents and purposes, the attorney general in Alaska is more powerful than the lieutenant governor in terms of just sort of scope of power and responsibility. nothing against our current lieutenant governor by any means. I think that's a fair point to make, that the precedent exists. This would be moving that further, and that's just something we should acknowledge.
Thank you very much. Well said. Representative Keller.
Just want to say to Representative Isaacson that I appreciate your confidence in the fact that Judiciary will review this, and I just want to put on the record that we will consider an amendment, on the partisan issue, and I would ask that you get your testimony either written from this committee or review it and present it. I will welcome that in the discussion very much as part of the discussion in Judiciary. Just for efficiency's sake, I'm not ramming or pushing, the committee here to do anything, but for efficiency's sake, this, I just want to say it will be handled, and that will give the sponsor some time to formulate his thoughts on this issue. So if we, and I also want to say that the other two issues that I will make sure, I won't say there'll be an amendment, but we'll consider, is the removal standards that Representative Hughes talked about, and also I believe Mike Coons, our testifier, brought a good point up. I think we've got to consider just exactly what the qualification should be, at least weigh that. So those are the things I anticipate looking at in Judiciary.
And I like the point that, I guess, Reverend Christ Tompkins said, there's a difference between campaign ability and legal ability. Sometimes they both get some one higher than the other. Just because somebody is a good campaigner and can achieve public office does not necessarily mean they're going to perform well in that office. It's two totally different things. We've all seen that at one time or another. Okay.
And just one final thought. As a political junkie, I do really like the idea of having another statewide, race to follow. It's kind of like, if you're a baseball fan, you've got a whole other league to enjoy watching.
Okay. If there's no other public testimony, Representative Hughes.
And actually, I was going to ask Representative Keller what exactly, so thank you, because that removal piece is important, and I do think that needs be deliberated. I was just curious if I could ask the sponsor a question, because I believe there are 43 states right now where it is an elected position. Do we know of those 43, how many have addressed the partisan? I can see just by the red and blue that we have some that are not of the same party, but of the 43, are there states that part of their law requires that they be of the same party? Do we know that number? Just as this is going forward to Judiciary,
yes.
It would be interesting to know how of the 43 states, how they've come down.
And Representative Hughes, through the chair, I'm not going to forget all these comments if you choose to move this out of the committee, because you're ultimately going to be voting on the floor, and you've asked a lot of good questions. So once this bill moves out, if that's the will, I want to work with all of you on your concerns on that on the process. I would just, going back just one step, though, the notion of somebody elected to a position who isn't intimately involved with our state. Actually, we've had that dynamic with appointed positions where, because you don't have to be a resident of the state to be appointed. Very recently, that's been the case. And if we anecdotally look at that, one of the recent appointees, a governor or two back, maybe the person left the state right after their service as Attorney General. And there are qualification requirements that are the same as the other elected executive positions on residency and citizenship. And those are actually, I think it might provide Representative Isaacson more comfort that there's an assurance that the Attorney General is actually an Alaskan. And it's hard to imagine somebody running that didn't have, well, first of all, they'd be legally prevented if they didn't have the residency of the state, and we just don't get people that run for statewide that have only, for our statewide state offices, we have people running, living in other states because the federal government doesn't have qualifications, not to confuse that, but I think it should provide assurances that that it would more likely to be someone that is familiar with Alaska and its economy and our legal system because they've lived here and worked here, and that's I can't imagine somebody for running for office for one of our state constitutional offices that didn't have those qualifications. It'd almost be a joke to run without them. But we do have direct evidence that people are appointed from other states. Some of them haven't even been immediate members of the bar and had to go secure that credential. So that's through the existing appointment process.
Thank you very much. The committee ready? Reverend Keller, Vice Chair Keller, would you care to make a motion?
Yeah, I'd move H.R. 18, version A, out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay. Without objection, moves out of committee. Thank you for bringing this before. Very, very interesting.
Thank you for your thoughtful questions and giving me some more work to do.
Thank you. Now bring HB 275 before the committee, and do you want to? It's coming around. I take a short at ease while we. House State Affairs Committee will please come back to order. We have before us Representative Mike Hawker. Please introduce yourself and your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it.
And bring the microphone toward you there. Thank you.
Even closer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to be back in front of the House State Affairs Committee. I'm Representative Mike Hawker. I represent District 27 in South Anchorage in the Upper Hillside. House Bill 275 is a bill that really has two major sections in it. Both sections are about our ability to promote efficiency and effectiveness of government and to reduce unnecessary government spending. We can call that perhaps eliminate government waste. The first three sections of this legislation affect municipalities. The last two affect state agencies. To the first three sections, this bill makes it permissive, emphasize the word permissive, that municipalities, in the case of three types of public notices they are currently required to post in printed media, to no longer, if they choose to no longer post those in printed media, but in lieu of that, adopt an online publication system. Again, it emphasized this is permissive
And in order to do it, it would be a local choice based on the facts and circumstances in that committee. The three types of notices that this bill affects are posting of mill rates, it is the posting of foreclosure notices, and it is the posting of redemption of foreclosure notices. Again, this is a particular section that this folks have been in this legislature a while have actually seen this bill. It once, a couple, 3 years ago, made it all the way to the other body, and then, you know, we got close to end of session. It didn't get anywhere, but this was a provision, those sections 1 through 3 that were added after consultation with and listening to our legislative, listening to concerns raised by municipalities. So it was us being responsive to the interests of our municipalities. The real core of this bill is in section 4 and 5. And this is these are sections that are intended to reduce what I have always seen in this building as a legislator of wasteful paperwork processing. I mean, we all come to Juneau every year, and we all know how many state reports get dropped on our desk, and every day we go to that mailbox and there's another stack of state reports in it. And I really question how many of us read those reports. How many of those reports get anywhere close farther than either to a bookshelf or to a wastebasket? You know, we all individually have some that we gravitate to and we find of interest, but yet we, over time, as a legislature, have said all these reports need to be prepared, they need to be delivered to the legislature, and our agencies are dutifully delivering them, but to what good, other than the costs involved? So this bill specifically allows and requires, actually, this is not an allowance, but this becomes mandatory that those reports are given to us electronically, provided to us electronically rather than in print. But recognizing that there is no one-size-fits-all law. And if we were to simply say that, I'm sure every one of us could find an exception to that. And we'd say, well, wait a second, we don't want this to happen. But so this bill specifically provides three exceptions to the electronic distribution and posting rules, and that is that there shall be the printed copies shall still be provided to the state library for permanent archiving, and this is on actually page 5 of the bill, the very last section. I'll get to the current version of the bill to make sure I'm working on the right one here. At the top there, page 5 of the bill, when there is an agreement with a state agency or where federal law mandates it. So again, trying to be permissive as much as we can, to be as strong as we can in saying you will report electronically, but we're giving you all the latitude you need to make judgments. And that's where item 2 there comes in on line 5. And it's very important because I believe that our department heads, as we implement legislation like this, need the authority to make that decision for themselves. They know that we're saying as a policy call, guys, stop sending us all this paper. But we know there's some that are that important that you need to be providing in paper, and that's why we say, or specifically approved by the head of the state agency or the head's designee. Again, providing a great deal of latitude to the agency. So we're not compromising anything, but we are, in fact, saying start saving money here. Start being more efficient and effective with our state assets. you know, Mr. Chair, that's really the whole substance of the bill in front of us. It's intended to be one, again, to increase the, as I said before, the efficiency, effectiveness of government without compromising the public's right to know or our ability to access information. We'll also note that the section, I'm going to bounce back up to section 4. Well, what are we going to do in lieu of the paper reports? You know, just to, they finish a report and it sits over there in the computer at an agency, that's not going to do a whole lot of good either. So we've got this fantastic system in the state of Alaska called the Online Public Notices System. We get those notices in our mailbox, our electronic mailbox, every day. And so this bill provides on page 4, line 24, that those reports of state agencies are put on the Online Public Notices System. And anybody in the public, ourselves as well as anybody in the public that subscribes to those notices, can get the online notice of those. I mean, as they become available and are published on that system, everybody gets a notice that they're available. See one that's interesting to you? You go for it, bring it up. And if you choose to, you print it off on your printer. Various estimates, but actually back off half a step, if I might, may bring this testimony to a close. This legislation, as I've brought it forward, is not intended to be encompassing, completely comprehensive, to capture every possible efficiency we can capture. It is intended to be a bite at the apple, a beginning bite of making the government activities more efficient. And that's why we're starting with just these reports of state agencies to the legislature. And then if this gets worked out, I think it's a topic that will merit further consideration in future years for potential expansion. But let's take a small bite first. Let's see what works. Let's work out the bugs. Make sure that the online public notices system is working as anticipated. In our conversation with the online notices people, they agree that they certainly have the latitude and without any additional costs to also, as reports are provided to them, not only will they publish a notice of those reports, but they'll maintain on that system an index of such reports. So you can always go look and say, let's see what reports are available. Or if you talk to an agency and they say, oh, that report was this, it was on the notices system, there it is. You just go and it's all cross-linked. Again, us in the state of Alaska attempting to remain, quite frankly, on the leading edge of our implementation of technology and cost efficiency through contemporary technology as we operate our governments. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's the legislation proposal.
Do you have any idea, wag or a swag, of how much money might be saved if this bill were to pass?
Mr. Chairman, thank you very kindly. Acknowledging that it is just that, a wag or a swag.
I'll define that later for members of the committee.
The universe we're working with is back in 2011, we had statewide publications of all kinds of publications the state does, and they were coming out with like $1,600,000. OMB in January 31, 2014, as we have narrowed the scope of this legislation a bit, believe that they are spending for this type of reports $530,000. The savings is going to be somewhere within that. I think it's very realistic to think that we could have a material savings across all agencies with the bill. And then as we act with this first bite at the apple, and as it is worked out and we see how it's working, that in future years I think we could go after a much larger bite of the apple and go after that, the second $1 million that's out there. And again, be more efficient and effective without compromising the public's need to know.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Representative Hughes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not actually a question. It's a comment. Thank you, Representative Hawker, for this common sense. As a new legislator last year, one of the very first conclusions that I reached, there were a lot of reports coming in. It would be very difficult to read every page of every one, and even the space to keep them was a concern. And I remember having a conversation. I maybe even did an email where I made a suggestion. I didn't know that we needed to pass the statute to do it, that they would be provided electronically, and that as legislators we would have a page where we could go and see all the reports. Because if you were to ask me right now what is what mandated reporting comes to us, I couldn't tell you everything. So it would be great even to have a list to see all those things. So I do appreciate it. I do have one question on page 5 of the bill. I don't believe you discussed it. I'm just curious. the on line 13 regarding the graphic design for the reports, how that section came to be and why the need for that is there.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, I could touch on a couple of your points and then get to the paragraph you've referenced here. I very much appreciate the observation you made as an incoming legislator. You know, one of the things that was done years ago was mandate that each one of those reports you get has a title page item that says how much it costs to print that report. And I have always kind of glanced at that going, somebody just spent $11 on a report that is going into the recycle bin. You know, I think of a couple that are literally inches thick. And they are doing that. I want to emphasize, this isn't intentional waste on behalf of our agencies. We, the legislature, told them they shall submit a report. So, yes, it does take statute for us to tell them, oh, by the way, what we meant by that now, how we will interpret that is to allow electronic reporting. Something else that has really crossed my attention is some of this reporting that we get from these agencies seems to be rather high on the aesthetic and beauty side in relation to sometimes to its technical content. And that's where this graphics design language came in. And this is, again, language carried over from the first time this bill moved through the legislature back 3 years ago. And we're simply directing our agencies that when you're doing this simple reporting to us, and just as it says, a state agency may not hire contractors to provide photographs or graphics. I mean, bless them, they might look pretty, but are they necessary? Unless, and we're providing the out again, that there's no agency employee who's qualified to perform the work. So basically, there's nothing there that says they can't go out and use their own people, take the pictures they want to include in their report. But we also put in there that, or that the agency would use fewer state resources by hiring a contractor sort of thing. If they need a picture of for their report of something that happened in who knows where, get somebody up there to take the picture and send it on down to them. We're not forcing them to say, okay, we're going to send an employee from here to there and back again and spend the airfare and all the other associated expenses. So I think we've got a good balance here that simply is telling our agencies, we don't need all the pretty, we need the substance. And yes, we're going to use pictures and graphics. We want it done by state employees already on the payroll unless it's cheaper to use someone else.
Follow up?
Yes, and as you've been reviewing these reports for more years than I have, was there problems where there was a lot being spent on hiring contracts, flying them around to take photos? It seems like that could have happened on occasion, but was it specifically a problem and that's why you included it?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, I use that as a intellectual example of what might be. I have no idea if an agency has or has not done that, but I have as a legislator remarked upon the large volume of what would appear to be very costly photographs in reports to us that, as I say, are all kind of coming in and going by the wayside so very quickly.
Thank you.
Again, and Mr. Chair, Representative Hughes, the concept behind this bill is to give as much, to allow the agency head to retain as much latitude as is possible in making these decisions themselves, but yet being very mindful that our policy call as a legislature is saying, let's be more efficient and effective with the utilization of our resources.
Thank you. Vice Chair Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, thanks. I'm grateful for the fact that you brought the bill forward. I do have a question. It's along the same lines as Representative Hughes. Yeah, on that section, lines 13 through 17, was it the second page, fifth page?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. As I read that, I just wanted to put a few things on the record so you could respond to it. But our intent and our desire is to get the information out. It is not to quell the information getting out, and I'm sure you agree, and you've talked about this. It just that to me, I would like to just state that I wouldn't mind if the agency spent a little bit of money doing some work in the area of getting the information available with applications, for example, a specialized application where I could go on my iPad and get reporting on a particular thing. I think that would help getting the information out. I got talking to a media consultant here a couple months ago when we were working on the federal overreach summit, and he pointed out that most younger generation now get most of their information from video clips. You know, so when you're, you know, when we're talking about this information system, I just want to put this on the record that from my perspective as an individual, for the when they're working on this system, that they, I sure wouldn't mind if they spend some money making sure that it was, you know, that you could, we could get apps, you know, for portable, more and more portable devices, and that they look at new ways of getting the information out so that it's there. And that will cost them money, but my guess is that they could handle that within the system. I wouldn't want to propose an amendment to the bill. I just wanted to put this on the record and get your response.
Mr. Chairman, as you well know, and Representative Keller, the testimony that is built during the process of legislation is very important to make sure the intent is clear. And I very much confirm that as you have interpreted a need in the state, it is absolutely not compromised by this legislation in any way, shape, or form.
Thank you. Reverend Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is just terrific. It's fantastic. I had the similar phenomenon as my colleague to the left in the first year, sort of seeing reports stream in by mail, and I would always flip to the price of each report and react in a similar fashion. And the section on graphic design on page 5, I think, is so appropriate, knowing how much good graphic design costs in it. I mean, I think there's this incentive structure for state agencies and commissions to sort of out-graphic design each other because they're trying to curry favor with the legislature for funding or whatever other reason. So you've got more smiling children on each page and more beautiful Alaska vistas on each page and more textured paper or translucent paper. I mean, it's practically the NASA of printing and graphic design we're seeing in these state reports. And the cost of the design, not just the printing cost, has got to be extraordinary. And when we're hearing numbers like $500,000 to over $1 million, it's not, you know, it's not just a symbolic gesture, but it's real savings. And I actually suspect that language on page 5 might result in greater savings than simply electronic dissemination, because it's really expensive to design that well. So it's a wonderful bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Is Kay Wasserman online?
No.
You're here. Well, wherever we are, come on up. This is better than being online.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kathy Wasserman. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Municipal League. The League is in full support of this bill. First of all, I want to say this is the first time in the many, many years that I've been involved with local government where I've actually seen the state relax a mandate on municipalities. And that right there is a reason for celebration, which we'll do later this evening. But I would like to say that most communities know how best to get a hold or to get information to their people. And unlike you, and this is not meant to be disrespectful, people in municipalities, the elected officials, have no way to go to another community for 90 days to separate themselves from their constituents. You see them every day on the boardwalk, on the sidewalk, in the grocery store, at the post office. So a municipal official knows very early and very well if they have not gotten information out. So I think that the communities can, in fact, do that best and know how that should be taken care of. As a former mayor and in many small communities, I was required many years ago to post everything in the closest newspaper. And that newspaper, with a little bit of luck, got to my community 6 days later. So it was just a waste. And but I know how to get the information out to those people, and other municipalities do as well. So we certainly support this bill and thank Representative Hawker for submitting this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I know when I served on a city council in California, they're all over you. Here we are somewhat isolated. We should not be as isolated. Representative Christ Tompkins, excuse me, Representative Isaacson.
I know we're both young, and it's often confusing.
And you have other similarities,
it's
too.
It's the hairdo. Kathy, I'm very glad that you came forward. Notice I held my tongue until you came forward. I didn't want to detract from whatever possible testimony you might have because...
A first?
We're in a public forum, so I'll hold my tongue.
Make sure you've got that on the record. Okay, go ahead.
But I echo what you're saying and look at this as an extremely helpful bill, especially in the, as you described it, posting requirements, and that this is elective. This is good, and I want to make sure people know that. But don't celebrate yet because this still has to get passed by the bodies, and then there's some heavy lifting. But has AML actually taken gotten a lot of feedback on this one? Have you heard from the clerks and such, or is it just something that is going to be good to let them know and you can hear the rejoicing in the streets and the town halls?
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, I have heard from a few communities, not many. Our winter meeting is next week, and we will discuss this at length. But I guess I've been in this job long enough that, you know, we have few mission statements, and the first one is local control. And if a bill falls under local control, for the most part, we would never, ever go against it. So that fulfills our first mission, local control. So it's a no-brainer.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again for being here.
You don't want state intrusion like we have. You don't want state overreach.
That would be in another hearing in itself.
I guess so. Debbie Reich? Reich?
Yes? I'm here.
You introduce yourself and give us any testimony you'd like.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and the members of the committee. For the record, my name is Debbie Reich, and I'm with the Municipality of Anchorage Real Estate Department. I would like to offer some brief comments on HB 275. The Municipality of Anchorage supports HB 275 and appreciates the bill's sponsor, including the provisions within the bill that provides municipalities across the state the option to publish foreclosure notices online or on local news publications. This change to state statute would save the Municipality of Anchorage the minimum of $20,000 annually. During times when budgets across the states are incredibly slim, we believe the savings is quite significant. We sincerely appreciate Representative Hawker's bringing this bill forward, and I appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony. I'm available to answer any questions that the committee may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I get them calculating in my mind, how much do I save in my property taxes in Anchorage? Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Anybody else online to testify? I have some names here for to answer questions only. Anybody want to make any comments? If not, anybody in the audience? Okay, I'm going to close public testimony. Committee discussion? Mr. Vice Chair,
I'm going to presume here a little bit. I would move HB 275 CRA out of the committee of version Oscar with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay. Without objection, this bill passes from committee. We'll ask the next group to come up, please, to testify, and we'll take a short break while we do the paperwork. come back to order. We have a very important bill before us now, and that is HB 199 involving firearms for VPSOs, Village Public Safety Officers. As the sponsor, please introduce himself and give us an overview of this bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to come forward with House Bill 199. For the record, my name is Representative Bryce Edgman, and I represent House District 36. The bill itself is pretty straightforward in its intent, but before I get to describing the bill, I'd like to take maybe 2 minutes to talk a little bit about the VPSO program, just to maybe refamiliarize those that may not be as familiar with the program as some of us are. But the VPSO program was established in the late 70s and the early 80s to provide public safety to essentially the outlying rural communities that didn't have access to regular law enforcement presence. The program has been around, and I would say, by and large, been very successful for the most part. The actual numbers statewide have ebbed and flowed. The high water mark in terms of VPSOs was in the early 90s at 125 VPSOs, so essentially 125 or so communities. The number thereon has risen and fallen depending on the particular circumstances. Right now, of the 120-plus authorized positions, there is some 92 or 93 actual working VPSOs, and the reasons for the coming and going of VPSOs are related to particular circumstances, of course, in the communities, and sort of, I think, underscore one of the fundamental issues with the program, and that's been the turnover of VPSOs in the communities. You know, I'm born and raised in rural Alaska. I'm from Dillingham, so I'm pretty familiar with the circumstances surrounding the VPSO program in my part of the state. And as I've researched this bill, I've come to learn and appreciate more about what VPSOs do in all of rural Alaska. And I'm pretty proud of some of the changes that occurred in rural Alaska over the years. You know, I could point to a number of our smaller communities having better runways, having modern health clinics, having, in some instances, new schools, having much more facilities, much more other opportunities to live the subsistence slash cash lifestyle that rural Alaska has really come to depend upon. But I'm here to tell you as well that in some communities and in some areas quite pervasively, we have seen the influx of hard drugs, of methamphetamines, of heroin, other substance abuse issues. Certainly alcohol, as we all know, is pervasive, not just in rural Alaska, but in Alaska as a whole. So a lot of these problems have created an environment where in some rural communities we've seen much more violence and a much more lethal environment for VPSOs to operate in. So all this to get to the bill itself, Mr. Chairman, sort of came to a head last March, actually March 19th, when unfortunately a VPSO in a nearby community, Manicotic, a nearby community of Dillingham, lost his life in the course of duty. And so it got me to thinking. And as I was, I got to escape to go home for a couple of days at the very end of March, which I normally don't get to do, and it's during session. But it just happened at the Penn Air Terminal, there was a couple of VPSOs, one who was a roving VPSO and another who served the Chinooks. And so I pulled them aside and I said, tell me what you do and tell me what how you're armed, and I want to know more about just exactly what it is that you confront regularly. And the story that I got was just, again, from two VPSOs was some pretty harrowing accounts of having to deal with perpetrators, some with high-powered rifles, some with other arms that put the VPSO, and in some instances, I shouldn't say the family, but the VPSO, him or herself, in a very, very dangerous situation. So we introduced House Bill 99, which would essentially, as you can read the one line, would essentially give the department the authority or require them not to prohibit VPSOs from being armed, And I'd like to really underline and underscore that the whole notion of arming VPSOs would only come in terms of having a very careful vetting process of the VPSOs meeting, as the bill describes, the minimum standards and training for carrying firearms. And that's something that you might want to query the department on when they come up to testify on the bill, because that's been a big emphasis of putting this bill forward, that VPSOs would receive the proper training, would receive everything that they need to be able to confront the situations that heretofore they have not had to confront, being armed with weapons. We've, again, through the course of researching this bill, we've been in contact with a lot of the not-for-profit associations around the state, with a lot of members of the rural community. I think the support is broad, it's widespread. There are a few communities who have some trepidation, as you might imagine, and probably may not want to have an armed VPSO, but the way this bill is structured, at least the intent, is that decision-making would take place between the departments, between the Regional Native Association, and the community itself. And again, you'll hear the department talk about how that program would be structured behind the scenes in terms of the regulatory putting together of the program. There is a fiscal note, Mr. Chairman. It's $62,000 or so a year, and this is based on the department's premise that 20 or so VPSOs would actually be brought down to the Trading Academy in Sitka. And as you can see, the fiscal note is broken out into three components: the travel part itself, the liability part under the services component, and the commodities aspect, which is the actual buying of handguns and holsters and ammunition and so forth and so on. What I would like to do in terms of my parting comment, Mr. Chairman, is to make note that late last week we learned of a VPSO program oversight issue that the department is now in the process of rectifying. And we'd like to, in that spirit, ask with your consent that we bring up the department's Captain Steve Arlo, who oversees the VPSO program for the state troopers, to actually talk to the committee about the issue, and then later on, if time permits, have the deputy commissioner provide more detailed information about the actual training program itself that the department will administer for the VPSOs, assuming that this bill actually makes it through the process. And my last comment is to say that the department, in conjunction with this legislation last session, actually set about putting into effect regulations that would allow for the arming of VPSOs, or that would not prohibit a regional association and a community coming forward to work towards the process of getting VPSO armed. But the thrust behind House Bill 199 is to put that language firmly in the state law so that it's there, quote-unquote, into perpetuity, and it helps legitimize the program in terms of any other sort of secondary or tenant issues that will follow the arming of VPSOs in rural Alaska. So with that, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to present to House Bill 199.
And so, once again, this would be a local option of the local community to arm or not to arm. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. It would be an opt-in program, and I think there's full agreement on that being a sort of a critical part of this whole aspect.
Thank you. Mr. Arlo, please introduce yourself. And excuse me, Trooper Arlo. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Captain Steve Arlo with the Department of Public Safety, Alaska State Troopers, and I run the Village Public Safety Officer Program for the department and have so for the last 8 years. I'm very familiar with the program, the ins and outs. I've spent a good part of my career in rural Alaska, so I'm familiar with all the issues associated with the program and why we have the program. Regarding to Mr. or Senator Edgman's comment about there's a particular issue that's kind of on the forefront regarding a particular VPSO. If you'd like, I'd be glad to go into that.
Speak up a little bit, please.
If you'd like, I'd be glad to go into that particular issue.
Yes, I'd like some information on that, because that's been a major concern.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, without going into specific names of VPSOs, I bring to the attention of the committee that we did have an event in 2012 where a VPSO was hired by a particular nonprofit. The VPSO had a felony conviction.
And what was the conviction for?
The conviction was for a DUI where the individual was involved in an accident injuring somebody in the village by four-wheeler.
Were there no firearms involved?
No, sir, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I'd like to bring to the attention, there's a procedure that we go through when we process an application for the VPSO program. It's written in statute, or actually regulation 13AC. It gives me some guidelines on what our investigators are supposed to do, what they're supposed to look at, and what we can approve and not approve in a person's background. And it's clear in the regulation that it talks about a person with a felony conviction cannot enter into the VPSO program, and state funds cannot be used to hire a VPSO by these nonprofits, which are the hiring entity. Interesting enough, though, there's also regulation that talks about the Commissioner of Public Safety or his designee has the opportunity to review any denials in the process by a nonprofit if they write and ask us to consider a particular event. In this case, that's what happened. This particular case came through my desk after it had been reviewed by a first-line investigator that goes through a particular background. A sergeant supervisor that works for me, and the background on the case was basically that this person interested in becoming a VPSO was from the community, and interesting enough, his father was a VPSO for over 20 years. This was the first application we had in that region, or in that particular village, since his father had left. It's a very challenging role to find VPSOs to take these positions. The nonprofit was very supportive, saying that the community really was behind this particular VPSO, even with this information that dated back 12 years ago. This wasn't something that was very recent. This was a 12-year-old. And since that one event, that was the only event in his entire criminal history, we researched, since it was 12 years ago, we researched the documentation and the reports and reviewed it again just yesterday. And it appears it's a little, complex. It's unsure of all the details regarding this particular case. In fact, we even have a letter in this report from the district attorney that wants to decline prosecution because of insufficient evidence. But yet the case does go forward, and a plea agreement is made, and it's a plea down to a different level of assault, but it's still a felony assault. It also appears that it's the information about the event itself is a little unknown. The particular VPSO at the time wasn't a VPSO, but it appears that he was at a party with the victim, and they either had left together on this four-wheeler and something had occurred where the accident happened and that particular person victim was injured, or it was also potential that they had left the party at different periods of time and he may have struck her when he stopped to ask, hey, would you like a ride? We're not quite sure the total events. That's why maybe the district attorney was unsure about prosecuting. So it's a little muddied on how all the events, but I guess the reason I shared that with you is because this is a clear example of why we have regulations that give us guidance, but why there's also a stipulation that allows a commissioner or his designee to look at these on a case-by-case basis to determine, is this truly the intent of the law, the letter of the law? And I guess I would pose in this case, this is the only particular individual in the program right now that we have that has this background of a felony conviction. We don't make it a practice, but it is something that in this case we did have one.
And so there has, in fact, been an actual conviction.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it was a plea agreement, and the conviction is entered as a felony conviction.
And is this particular VPSO still employed as a VPSO?
Mr. Chairman, yes, he is. And all indications are, as we look at his performance, he's doing a very good job.
Okay, thank you. And what's the entry-level pay for VPSO?
Mr. Chairman, currently the VPSO starting salaries are approximately about $25 per hour, but there's also additional $25 per hour. There's also additional benefits depending on which nonprofit you're in, benefit packages. Also, the communities provide, in some instances, housing and stipends for fuel and other things if you're living in a rural village.
Thank you very, very much. We're about out of time here, but any questions from the committee for the trooper? You're first. Representative Hughes.
Yeah, thank you, Captain, for your testimony. I'm just wondering, 93, I believe Representative Edgman mentioned, are currently serving as VPSOs. How many villages is that? And then also, what is the response time for a trooper to, I know there's a range, but knowing the distance of the villages and that it requires air travel, what would be the range of time that it would be expected to wait until a trooper could arrive, an armed trooper?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, the first part of your question, there are 69 communities currently that are serviced by VPSOs, but we have the additional rover program where there's VPSOs assigned to hub rural communities that rove out and touch other communities other than those 69. And with regards to a response time by a trooper on any particular crimes in rural Alaska, it would be a very difficult thing to answer. I can tell you, having been the detachment commander for western part of Alaska for many years, there are times where our troopers do an excellent job and get to the villages the same day or even within hours of an event that we are reported to. And there are other occasions where the troopers, due to weather, due to other priorities, we don't have enough troopers to be able to cover all 229 villages. If all 229 villages were to call us today and say there's an event in their community, we have to prioritize. It's a very difficult question to ask. I know that our troopers do their best to respond to calls and have to prioritize them.
Thank you.
Follow-up. Thank
follow-up.
You.
I'm about out
that,
of time.
Yeah, that question was just having lived out in bush communities, the response time is a concern and thus the need for this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Isaacson.
It's my understanding you're going to hold this over. I'll wait.
Yes, because of time constraints, we're going to hold over. I think it's a very, very important bill. And for all of us, particularly those folks in the villages out there who need good, quick, adequate public safety. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'm going to try to, if we can, bring this forward on the next, very next State Affairs Committee meeting. So I'm going to close testimony on HB 275 at this time, announce that our next meeting is this coming Thursday, the 13th. We will be hearing, I hope, the same bill on the armed VPSO, and then HB 273, extending the Council on Domestic Violence, and HB 284, Compact for a Balanced Budget. Anything else before they come to the committee? Yes, and on the this bill 275, we are in fact, well, not 275, but
199.
On HB 199, we're keeping public testimony open on that. So with that, thank you, everybody. Good day. We are adjourned.